WLFP Braddock.
It's a strange voice introducing on the menu today. Unfortunately, Miss N isn't able to be with us today, so this is Peter flying solo. You are listening to On the Menu, a radio program all about food, travel, and lifestyle. Good morning to our listeners in the East. A very early morning to those on the West Coast. Good afternoon to you in Europe, and good day to you down under in Australia and New Zealand, where it's already Monday. We have a action-packed show today, which N helped put together, so I think you're in good hands. With me only because my co-host has been involved in all the planning. We have a wonderful guest starting off the program, Alison Hooper, who is with the Vermont Butter and Cheese Company. Alison, good morning.
Good morning to you.
And I have to tell you, I mean, I have to get this out first. Mm-hmm. You sent us some wonderful samples. Anne ate one of them all on her own, right out of the box.
Oh, now I'll have to send some more.
It was so wonderful. It is, in my view, and I have tasted a lot of goat cheese, absolutely the best goat cheese I have ever tasted in my whole life.
Wow. Well, there's a testimonial.
And it was. I had it at the right temperature. It was fresh. You had just sent it. It was an absolute delight.
Good. That's great.
But I think we met you at the Fancy Food Show in New York. And you must have been an award winner there somehow, sometime.
We were. We won our little bambouche, which is the French for the good mouthful. Little goat cheese won best cheese and dairy product at the Fancy Food Show.
Well, there's a reason why. I absolutely, obviously agree with the judges.
Yep.
Now, you're more than just a cheesemaker, but let's start out talking about how you got into making goat cheese, because it's not the most obvious career path.
No, it certainly isn't. It certainly wasn't, many years ago. I was a French major in college, and I was in Paris my junior year abroad, and I needed to find a job or something to do during the summer. And, of course, I didn't have any working papers, so I worked on a farm in Brittany, and we had a various menagerie of goats and sheep and cows and pigs, and we made goat cheese and butter and creme fraiche and fromage blanc, all the things that we make today, and we made charcuterie and sausage, and it was a wonderful experience, and I thought, gee, this is great, and Americans need this. So, and this was 1980. So.
Yeah, but the story, after you came back then, I mean, you didn't start making goat cheese as soon as you got back.
Not at all.
And there's a guy called Bob somewhere in the mix.
That's right. Bob is my partner. We started the business 23 years ago, and we're still together, miraculously, I suppose. Bob was putting together, we had both worked in the Agency of Agriculture in Vermont. He was putting together a dinner for a chef. At the time, this was a Restaurateur of the Year award, and all of the ingredients for this dinner had to be made in Vermont. And the chef was looking for goat cheese to serve with lamb. And of course, in 1984, you couldn't go to the supermarket and buy goat cheese. It just wasn't really an American thing. So Bob said, well, gee, there's somebody here who went to France and made cheese. I'll get you some cheese, chef. And
oh, my God.
I made some cheese for him and was invited to this dinner as a producer. And, of course, sat at a table with Bob, and chefs were bringing their cards up and saying, we'd like to buy your cheese. And I thought, well, gee, I'm really not in the business or prepared to do that. And it was Bob's wife who said, well, gee, Bob, you and Alison should start a cheese business. And we sort of looked each other over and thought, well, okay, here we go.
Okay, now, you were at that time, you were obviously getting milk from somebody else. Do you now have your own herd, or do you still do the same thing?
No, we buy milk from about 20 farms in Vermont now. And back then, it was very hard to find milk. There was really only one commercial goat herd in the state, and that's where we were able to get that milk. So
now, you know Cypress Grove on the other coast, right?
Absolutely, yes. Mary's a good friend of mine.
Mary's fabulous. We asked her when she was on the program why she got into making goat cheese, and he started out saying, I had four children and I was a single parent.
Yeah, we all have a similar story, and we all really started at a time when there really wasn't a market. I mean, it was really out of a passion for making cheese or something, you know, whether it's to take care of your kids or be at home or whatever.
Sure. Bear with me just a second. I think that the next guest is on the line, and I think she'll enjoy talking to you as well. So before we go any further, let me welcome from sustainabletable.org, Leslie Hatfield. Leslie, how are you this afternoon?
Hi, actually, this is Diane Hatt.
Oh, my goodness. I'm allowed to make a few mistakes because my co-host isn't able to be here today. But Diane, thank you for joining. We got off to a slightly late start with the program because I got stuck in traffic on the way to the studio. So we're still talking to Allison Hooper from the Vermont Butter and Cheese Company. You're welcome to listen in, and if you have any observations, give us those observations. I've already complimented Allison that this is absolutely the best goat cheese I ever tasted in my whole life, and my wife agreed with me, and she wolfed down a whole package straight out of the box without stopping. It's so wonderful. But Allison does more than that. She's also the founder of the American Cheese Society. Tell us about that, Allison.
Well, actually, I'm not the founder of the American Cheese Society. I started the Vermont Cheese Council, which is sort of a small cheese guild here in Vermont. Started in 1996, but I'm currently the president of the American Cheese Society.
Oh, okay. Well,
so
my,
everything sort of gets mixed up.
Yeah. My notes are a little faulty there.
Yeah.
But you've been instrumental in the evolution of the whole goat cheese business in the U.S., I guess.
Yeah, yes, indeed.
And there's lots of it now?
It seems like there's a lot of it, but, you know, it's certainly, we're just amazed at how much it's grown and how it's still growing. I think that, who'd have thunk that 25 years ago that Americans would have taken to this cheese as they have, and, you know, it's on all menus, and people that I run into every day just always have it in their refrigerator, and it just never occurred to me that that would happen. It's incredibly gratifying.
Right. So. No, I love not to keep it in the refrigerator, of course.
You have to keep it in your stomach.
I'd love to keep it somewhere where it's at the correct temperature.
Oh, indeed, yes.
And we were at a wonderful restaurant in London called Pied à Terre, and it's the first restaurant that I've ever heard of where they have a cheese refrigerator, which keeps it at the correct temperature instead of it getting too cold.
Yep, and that's starting to happen all over, yep.
So it's just a wonderful thing that's happening now. The material that I read, the background material I read, said that you're making your goat cheese in a French style, which is not really surprising, because after all, that's where you learned how to make goat cheese. But can you explain a little bit about what makes the French style somewhat unique and what makes your goat cheese unique?
You know, in the U.S., we eat cheddar. That's our big cheese, and certainly mozzarella is a big cheese because we're big pizza eaters here. So the proliferation of small artisanal producers around the country is really something that's really grown in the last 10 years. But when we say French style, these are small. Goat cheese tends to be sort of in a small format, a little pyramid or small croton. They're very delicate, small cheeses, kind of like the animal. And we call them lactic cheeses, so the curd is very soft. It's very fragile. It's like making yogurt and then draining it in a form. And then we age it in an aging room with high humidity and low temperature to develop a rind and develop the aroma. But that's a very typical, it's traditionally the French way.
And some are ash and some are not, right?
That's right. Okay. The ash is, people often ask, well, what's the ash on the cheese? And they think, well, is that dirt? Is that mold? And in fact, the ash comes from the poplar tree, and we blend it with salt, and ash is very alkaline. So it neutralizes the surface of the cheese, which promotes the growth of this particular rind that we're after, because the cheese is quite acidic when we first make it. So this helps to develop the particular flavor that we're after.
Now, you say it comes from a poplar tree.
It comes from France.
But, I mean, what is it? Is it leaves, or is it ground-up leaves, or is it burned wood?
Well, it's the carbon. It's the ash that's left over.
Okay, so you burn poplar wood, and then this is what's left over.
And sometimes people eat what's called pharmaceutical ash, you know, to help for the digestion.
But well, that's wonderful. I learned something I didn't know today. Always feel like it's a day worthwhile when that's happened.
Right.
And do you also make goat butter?
We don't make goat butter. We do make wonderful cow's milk butter.
Okay,
and
right.
we like it so well that okay. we have a hard time imagining that we could make anything better. We're a little bit snobby about it. But
We got some goat butter from another supplier whose name I won't mention because it's not the right thing to do when you're on the program. But we love this goat butter mm-hmm. product, and it's terrific for people with the allergy
right.
to butter products coming from cows. So
right. It's a great alternative.
So we wish you would make it. But last thing to make sure we don't miss out, your website is?
www.vt for Vermont, butter and, spelled out A-N-D, cheeseco.com.
Great. And products are available in what kind of stores?
Well, we're available in Whole Foods markets, so lots of small specialty retailers, Wegmans. I'm trying to think out in Pittsburgh. Well, your listeners are from all over.
Well, we have one Whole Foods, which is close to where I live.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always handy. And they're going to build another one. Wegmans is not in this area. Giant Eagle is in this area.
We have Giant Eagle.
Oh, great.
We have Heinen's. We have...
Wonderful.
Earth Fair down in the south and
can
Fresh
people,
Market.
Can people buy from you directly as well?
Yes, they can.
Okay. And you ship overnight or second day? Or?
We unfortunately always have to ship overnight
okay.
because it is quite perishable. So it's expensive to ship overnight. So what we prefer is try to steer people to a store near them. And
but if you want, listeners, take my word for it. If you love goat cheese and you don't mind spending a little money, get it the way they send it. Eat it before you refrigerate it. And you'll thank me for that advice.
Right.
Because it is so good when unrefrigerated.
You can also buy it at Williams-Sonoma or Murray'sCheese.com
okay,
or iGourmet, some of those kinds of websites.
Yeah. Diane, do you have any questions or comments for Allison?
I don't, though I have to say I found out that my local health food store sells your cheese, so I can't wait to try it.
Oh, good.
You absolutely have to try it. Now, one last question, because after all, you make it. I just guess when I let's suppose that I have to store your goat cheese in the refrigerator.
Right.
How long should I let it sit out of the refrigerator for it to be ideal?
Well, it depends. There's always a depends, right? It depends on the cheese. If it's one of those little ripened cheeses that have a rind on them, they'll come out to room temperature and soften very quickly because as these cheese ripen, that what we call the paste, which is the interior of the cheese, gets soft. That's the fermentation process. It kind of breaks down and gets runny. So they'll soften and come to room temperature certainly within an hour. And, of course, if it's summer, that'll be faster, right?
Yeah, but that's about what I was doing.
Yeah.
I like it when it's really runny under the rind. And it just tastes...
Eat it with a spoon.
It just tastes so sensational when you do that. Well,
Perfect.
It's been an absolute delight, Allison, to have you on the program and share the story of the Vermont Butter and Cheese Company. I'm sure you'll win many more awards. Thank you so much for joining us and listeners. No, get onto this product. You'll love it. And now it's time to take a break.
Great. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Bye.
The internet is crucial to your business. Everybody knows this, but did you know Nidhogg is the company you should call for internet service? Nidhogg, personal web page hosting for less. Business web page hosting, Nidhogg offers both Unix and NT server support. Nidhogg is the company you should call for dedicated internet access. Nidhogg offers DSL for high speed, low cost, always on access. DSL is great, it means no more dial up. Oh, by the way, do you remember that thing called the telephone? Do you remember when people used phone lines to access the internet? Oh, I'm sorry, you still use dial-up? Well, Nidhogg does that too. Local access telephone numbers? Okay, I don't understand it all either, but I do know that I need it, and I know where to get it. Nidhogg, Nidhogg.com, 412-661-5917. That's 661-5917, or log on, Nidhogg.com. Internet the Nidhogg way.
I know I need to pay attention to my health, but I just can't seem to find the time. Between rushing to work and taking care of the kids, there's not much time left over for me. So I decided to start small by eating more fruits and vegetables and being more active. And then I got the family to make some changes, too. We started by keeping a bowl of fresh fruit on the counter, and I limit the amount of sweet snacks I keep in the house. I've also found some creative ways to add more vegetables to our meals. We're taking more walks, and on the weekends, we head down to the pool at the rec center. It doesn't happen every day, but it does happen. You don't have to change your entire life to be healthier. Just make some simple changes and include your family. You'll see how easy and fun it can be.
You can make a difference. Eat smart, play hard. And when you do, your kids will too. A challenge from USDA.
We're back. We're back with On the Menu. If you're thinking that Anne's voice suddenly deepened, it really didn't. This is co-host Peter flying solo today because Anne can't be with us. So we're just doing our best. I already made several mistakes, but that I'm sure will be pointed out to me, and I'll wear the stripes that I deserve for doing that. But I'm doing my best, sweetheart, if you're listening. We have now with us Diane Hatz, who is the founder of an organization called Sustainable Table, and I'm just going to have her explain what Sustainable Table is all about. Diane?
Thanks, Peter. Sustainable Table, we're a nonprofit program. We're based out of New York City, and basically what we do is we just try to educate consumers about issues surrounding food. So we promote eating local, we promote sustainability, organic, going to your farmer's market, and we give people tips, tools, resources on how to eat better and healthier.
And how is this funded?
We're actually privately funded by a small family foundation.
Oh, that's wonderful. So somebody just thought this was, you had this idea and then they decided to support it. Was that how it went?
Yes. Originally, when I first came here, I was working on factory farming and industrial ag issues. If you know about factory farming and how animals are raised and industrial production, it's very depressing.
Oh, golly.
Yeah, and I have a background in marketing, so I spent a couple years doing it, and I found it very depressing. So I had just pitched the idea of starting Sustainable Table and being positive, and rather than talk about all the problems we have with food, celebrate all the positive things that are happening in the food movement.
Well, that's wonderful. We absolutely love Michael Pollan's book. We both read it from cover to cover, just about right through. It's just a wonderful piece of work.
The Omnivore's Dilemma?
The Omnivore's Dilemma, yes.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah, let me just let everybody know, of course, listeners, that you can actually buy this through the On the Menu website by going to the OTM bookshelf, and it's absolutely a wonderful book that everyone should read and then think about.
Yes.
It's a thinking man's view of what the world could be like rather than the world as it is, where we have cheap chicken that unfortunately the animals who produce it are greatly distressed and they're not very healthy, so they're not a very healthy part of your diet either. And there is another way, and Michael Pollan shows how. And your organization's on the same bandwagon, right, Diane?
Yes. We just did a cross-country road trip, and what we basically found is that the tide is turning, and I know there's still huge problems, but more and more people every day want to eat healthier. They're looking to buy locally, you know, and even organic isn't as important as sustainable as getting to know your local farmer. So it's very heartening what I'm seeing happening.
Well, this is just wonderful. Now, tell us about some of the organization's activities, and then we'll come back to this wonderful bus tour that you just made.
Sure. I mean, basically what we've been up into this tour, we have basically been an educational resource. So two of our projects are The Meatrix, which is this online animation about factory farming. It came out almost 4 years ago now, but became hugely successful. We still get dozens of emails a week from students and teachers around the world. We have it in 30 languages. If you want to view it, you can go to www.themetrix.com. There's three films now, and we use that as a tool to educate people. The other thing we have is called the Eat Well Guide, and the Eat Well Guide was my solution to the problem. I thought, you know, if we're going to tell people there's a problem with food, we have to offer a solution. So if you go to eatwellguide.org, and you can put in your zip code and just hit search, it'll bring up farm stores, restaurants, bed and breakfasts, and all these outlets in your local area that sell sustainably raised meat, poultry, dairy, and eggs. We're currently adding farmers markets to it, and I think we're going to be adding in vegetables, so we'll be completely sustainable within the next year.
No, I want to make sure I write those websites down myself, so can you do them again for me?
Sure. The movie is The Meatrix. It's a spoof on the Matrix film, so it's www.themeatrix, which is M-E-A-T-R-I-X.com. And then the Eat Well Guide is www.eatwellguide.org, O-R-G.
Eatwellguide.org. And
yep.
It's Matrix, M-A-T-R-I-X?
M-E-A.
Oh, M-E-A, okay.
It's meat.
Meat, ah, okay. Meatrix.
Yes, Matrix. So the star is Morpheus, and if you've seen the Matrix films, Morpheus was one of the characters. And Morpheus is a cow, and he wears sunglasses, and he rescues Leo, who's the pig, and Leo's the one. So
that's wonderful.
It's a spoof on the Matrix, and it's humorous, but it discusses very serious issues about factory farming in a very non-threatening way, and that's basically what we try to do. We also have handouts, so you can actually go onto our website, which is at www.sustainabletable.org, and on there we have things like if you want to go to your farmer's market and speak with your farmer and ask him questions about how his food was raised, you know, we figure people might not know the questions or the answers to listen for, so we provide them for you. So you can print them out. You can even download them onto your iPod if you're tech savvy. So we have a lot of tools that people can use. We have a blog where we keep people updated with news.
Oh, that's great.
We have a forum where people can come in and discuss with, you know, things with each other. We have a news and features section. One of our most popular is our issues section, where we break down all the issues surrounding food. So we have a page on antibiotics, hormones, pollution, genetic engineering. So if people are confused and they're like, you know, what does this mean or how does this affect my health, they can click onto our health page and then just learn very simply, you know, what's going on. We provide links to other groups, to papers, to reports. Everything's footnoted. And the other part of the site we have is called Sustainable Kitchen, where we've been collecting a lot of sustainable recipes and a lot of things that people can cook that are just healthier for them.
Great. Well, listeners, don't worry. I'm going to put all those websites up on themenuradio.com. So if you go there, if you didn't get to note these down, they'll be there for you to follow. Now let's go back to the first thing that Ann told me about was this wonderful bus trip across America that finished up at the Farm Aid concert on Randall's Island in New York just a short time ago.
Yeah.
And I we both thought it was so fascinating that we put the news about that up on the update section of the website, and that was the first time that I even knew anything about your organization and about the tour, but it sounds like it was great fun. Tell us some more about it.
Oh, it was so much fun. It's probably been about 8 months ago now. We were sitting around in a meeting, and, you know, I said to everyone, I think there's more happening in the sustainable food movement than people realize. And I think there's a lot of stuff happening under the radar. And I was like, why don't we go cross country? And I've road tripped a lot in my youth, and I always would love, in places like Virginia and West Virginia, I loved going in diners and to local places and eating pie. So I said, you know, I think if we ate pie across the country and with pies that were made from local sustainable ingredients, that we could actually educate people and promote local sustainable food through pie eating. And my funder happened to be there, and you know, one of the funders, and she was like, well, do it. Put a proposal together. So we rented a rock and roll tour bus. We wrapped it, so we had a huge Sustainable Table logo on the bus, and we traveled from West Hollywood all the way across the country to New York City and basically ate very, very, very well. I had hundreds of pies all in 40 days.
And how many people were on the bus?
It averaged. There were about between 5 to 7 people at a time. I did the entire trip, and I had different people come join me for like a week or 10 days, so we would always have fresh blood. So the trip was an unbelievable, memorable experience. There was very little sleep. What we also did is we blogged, we videoed, we took photos of everywhere we went, and we actually were trying to encourage people to come with us online and to tour with us virtually. So if anyone goes to sustainabletable.org, you'll see right on our homepage there's a link into our tour blog. It's really a tour site. Every day, every event we did, we posted a blog and put up photos. And what we found was that there is so much more happening in sustainable food. And I have to say, it's not a trend anymore. It's not a fad. It's not even a movement. Sustainable food is a way of life for a lot of people across the country. And I know most people think it's California or the East Coast, but I'm talking Laramie, Wyoming, you know, Montana, places where you would think, well, what's going on there? You know, Kansas, Nebraska. We were really pleasantly surprised. When we were in Laramie, we visited the University of Wyoming, and they had just started their first student farm, which they're using organic practices, and people from the co-op, which is just opening in Laramie, actually this month or next, it's the first food co-op in Wyoming that's opening. Some of the people from the co-op toured with us. While we were there, they started speaking to the university about how can we help you? Can we buy some of your vegetables and can we help you with planning next year? And then at breakfast, we met the woman who founded the farmers market in Laramie. And she said, how can I work with the university and with you, the co-op? How can we all work together? And that's what we found, is that sustainable food isn't just about food anymore. It's about connection. It's about rebuilding community. It's about people coming together and sharing not just food, but the experience of eating and just sharing with each other.
Now, how did you get on this bus? I mean, if I wanted to come on this bus, how would I have done that?
Well, if you had said, I'm media, I want to come on the bus, we would have let you come on.
But what about the ordinary people who came on? How did you choose them? I mean, did they have to buy a ticket? How did that work?
It was people that I worked with.
Okay,
it was either
right.
us, and there was another organization called Food and Water Watch that I worked very, very closely with. So it was staff from one of our organizations, and then some consultants I've worked with, like we have a consultant in California, Oregon. So we had them come on the road with us. So it was employees.
Well, that's great. Well, if you do this again next year, let us know in good time, and maybe we'll hitch a ride for some of the journey. It sounds like it might be a terrific fun.
It was a lot of fun, and we will definitely keep you in mind.
That's absolutely terrific. Now, this is a great resource. Again, all these websites will be, I'll put them all up on onthemenuradio.com, and so not worry about that. Diane, thank you so much for sharing the story with us on the program. It was a delight to talk to you, and I wish you well in continuing everything that you're doing. I'm going to say goodbye now, and we're going to take a break.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Bye.
The flagship station of the Lifestyle Talk Radio Network. This is 1550 WLFP. Pittsburgh.
Data security and speed can be what puts your business ahead of your competition, but cost is important too. You might be paying every month for bandwidth you don't use. Let's talk about your company's disaster recovery system. Is it as effective and secure as it could be? What are you paying for your T1 line? I'll bet we can offer you a better deal. We're ASP Station, a premier independent server co-location facility and high-speed internet access provider. Virtually unlimited bandwidth, co-location for your backup servers, off-site system backup, and secure access to your equipment 24/7. Check us out on the web at aspstation.net or call us at 412-661-6001. Easy number to remember, 412-661-6001. 6001 ASP Station 412-661-6001.
Okay, this is not Anne with a deep voice. This is Peter with his usual voice, because unfortunately Miss Anne can't join us on the program today, but we're soldiering on, flying solo as it were. And of course, at the beginning of the last segment, I forgot to say, of course, you can reach us at any time with email at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And we also encourage you to visit the website, www.onthemenuradio.com, because there are lots of other resources there. And all the programs we've recorded back until October 2005. So we are almost two years of fascinating shows there for you to browse through anytime you want to. Last week, I promised you a special treat. Truly one of the most outstanding women in wine, probably in the world, but certainly in the United States, has run an operation called Domaine Conaris in California. It's a sparkling wine operation owned by the Tattinger family of the famous French Champagne name. And we had a long and really interesting talk with Elaine, who runs this entire operation and has since the very beginning.
I met Eileen Crane on the phone as I was cooking salmon for our dinner. So I had to quickly say, I have to go do the salmon, but we're going to come and see you at Domaine Conaris. And here we are. It's a beautiful day, which is not uncommon here. We just met a very fascinating lady who's been involved in winemaking for, she admits, 3 decades, although I don't know how that's possible. She must have started at age 9. But Eileen Crane, who is the president of Domaine Conaris, has been here for the 20 years this establishment has been open. What she doesn't know about sparkling wine, I don't know. So I'm going to ask her to tell us all about it. Eileen?
Domaine Carneros is Domaine Carneros by Taittinger, and it's the beautiful sparkling wine facility, the rather grand French chateau up on the hill on the road between Napa and Sonoma. And I was hired in 1987 to oversee the construction and development of the winery. The winery's become a real landmark. So it's hard to believe that there was a time when it was just a pile of dirt with me in a construction trailer and a couple of dirt mover guys out there. But that was the case. And Domaine Carneros, over the last 20 years, has become a very well-recognized producer of sparkling wine. And in the past few years, also a recognized producer of Pinot Noir.
Now, there's a connection there, I mean, correct? And it's a common misconception that only red wine is made from red grapes, and yet you make wine that's clearly white out of red grapes called Pinot Noir. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, our sparkling wine, our Brut Vintage, is predominantly made from Pinot Noir. It's usually about 55% Pinot Noir. And the reason why our Brut Vintage, the Domaine Carneros by Taittinger Brut Vintage, is so clear or pale golden color is because we don't leave the grapes in contact with the skin. In fact, we handle the grapes extremely carefully to avoid color and tannin pickup. Now, when we make our red Pinot Noir, we leave the skins intentionally in contact with the juice for color pickup. And so it may seem rather strange that we make both Pinot Noir and sparkling wine, but the connection is that sparkling wine, in most cases, is predominantly Pinot Noir, and that it's just logical that we might have been tempted at some point to try to make Pinot Noir into a red wine, and in fact, we were. In 1992, we did what we thought was just a little experiment with Pinot Noir. We were looking for holiday gifts for the employees, and the holiday gift it turned out to be a little bit more than that. Claude Taittinger came to visit in October, asked if he could taste the Pinot Noir, or asked it what I had in barrels and if he could taste it. I said, yes, Mr. Taittinger. He tasted it and asked me to bring it to our marketing company and see what they thought of it. We've been making Pinot Noir since 1992. In 2003, we actually completed a separate Pinot Noir winery right behind the chateau. It looks like the carriage house. And when it opened on June 21st, solstice of 2003, it housed the largest solar collection system of any winery in the world. And it was we really started a movement in the California industry towards solar power. People were shocked, really, that such a conservative-looking winery would, in fact, house something that was sort of avant-garde for the industry. And yet, we are. We were the people who got the solar collection system movement going in California.
How would you compare your wines to the Taittinger champagnes of France? You're very carefully talking about them as sparkling wines, not champagne. But how do you think they compare?
Well, I do speak about my wines as sparkling wine or Carneros sparkling wine. Every so often there's someone who will say to me, and yes, it's nice, but it's not real French champagne. And my response to that is, yes, and theirs is not real Carneros. When I was first hired by the Taittingers in 1987, my second week on the job, Claude Taittinger called me and said, we're now of Carneros, and imitations are never as good as originals. I expect that you're going to make an original Carneros wine. And when you think of it, where would Picasso be today if he were trying to imitate Renoir? Well, you never would have heard of him. He was an original. He did something quite different. And we never have tried to make an imitation champagne. They do a relatively good job of that in France on their own. We didn't need to do it also.
your Picasso example is very interesting because Anne's a great expert on Picasso and Braque and all these other paintings, but the story goes that Picasso and Braque were together looking at paintings that they had done, and they couldn't recognize which ones were theirs. Do you think that there's any likelihood that that's going to happen with Carnera Sparkling Wine and Tattinger?
I doubt it, because I doubt that Domaine Carneras by Tattinger and the Tattinger wines made in the Champagne region will cross over, because it's different soil types, slightly different climates, although both very cool climate areas, and different winemakers. And also, they have different regulations in France. We have regulations here, but not nearly the quantity. We're rather lucky that way. We have fewer governmental agencies to deal with, although surprisingly, it seems like sometimes we've got about a zillion more, but in fact, not.
While we were between tracks, Eileen, you told me a really interesting story, something of which you were very proud. Tell our listeners.
The Le Rêve, which is Domaine Carneros Blanc Blanc, Le Rêve meaning the dream, Claude Tattinger asked me early on in my tenure at Domaine Carneros to make, as they have the world's best French Blanc de Blanc, he would like to have America's best Blanc de Blanc. And we created Le Rêve, the dream wine. And the Le Rêve was served by Claude Tattinger for his millennium party at the top of one of the Parisian hotels that he owns. So it made it a big debut for the turn of the millennium. But you don't have to be invited to one of Claude Tattinger's soirees in Paris to enjoy Domaine Carneros, although you might be. But you can stop at the beautiful Domaine Carneros Chateau, and you can, in the winter, enjoy the salon and the fireplace inside. And for two-thirds, three-quarters of the year, enjoy the terraces and look at the beautiful views, watch the vines grow. Many wineries you belly up to the bar at Domaine Carneros. It's all table service. You're seated. A server comes to you who's also a wine educator. You can learn about the wines. We have three wonderful sparkling wines that you can try. And we serve our wines with artisanal cheese plates. And if you choose, we also make lovely Pinot Noirs, and you can try all three Pinot Noirs that we produce. If you're inclined, you might also want to go on a tour, and that's a guided visit to our sparkling wine facilities. And during the visit, you will taste all three of our sparkling wines and have a guided tasting. And then towards the end, you'll taste the Pinot Noir and leave with a commemorative glass. And that really is, for first up, a wonderful way to see the winery. Something else you might consider is Domaine Carneros has the best wine club, I tell you modestly, in the industry. We do events at least monthly. And if you want to really feel like royalty, coming up the main staircase for a dinner on a July evening is just about as close to heaven as you'll ever get. And the Domaine Carneros Wine Club, you taste not only the wines that we generally have available, but some very special offerings. And you can reach us or find out about both what we offer in our salons, on our terraces, and in our wine club on domainecarneros.com. You can also call the winery at 707-257-0101 and learn more that way. But we do encourage you to look on our website because there's just lots and lots going on there. You can also order direct from the winery, but we are distributed nationally. We're distributed in all 50 states. We also export to England, France, Germany, Denmark, Japan, Canada, and the Americas.
Being a winemaker isn't really a typical career for someone who grew up in New Jersey and whose father discovered wine in 1944 when he started reconquering France. Eileen told us that fascinating piece of history, but I want her to just give us a little bit of her life story and how she got involved with wine and became such an expert and such a prominent person in the business, and what it's like to do that in a business that's extraordinarily non-traditional. for ladies. Tell us about that, Eileen.
I've always been intrigued by wines. We had wine at home. My father had a wine cellar in New Jersey in the 50s and 60s and let me taste from about the time I was 8. I was fascinated by where the wines came from. And I grew up and I had several other careers. I went off and did social work in Venezuela, came back and did a master's degree in nutrition at the University of Connecticut, which gave me a science background, which has actually been very useful in the wine business. I met a real-life winemaker at the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York, in the summer of 1977, and I decided that when I learned you could study winemaking in a place in California called Davis, that that was for me. I gave up a career, I came out to California knowing no one, really, and started over. Started as a part-time tour guide at Domaine Chandon, worked my way up, was hired in 1984 to oversee the construction development of Gloria Ferrer, and in 1987, I was hired to oversee the construction development and winemaking for Domaine Carneros. And I've been here 20 years. In fact, this week's been my 20th anniversary. Sparkling wine has always been a passion. People say, how did you decide? And it was what I like most often to drink. I also enjoy Pinot Noir, but at the same time, I've met very few wines that I haven't enjoyed. The women, when I was first out here, when I first came out here in 1977, I was rather discouraged from going into the wine business. I was told by a professor at Davis that I'd have to take all my classes over again, basically 6 years from undergraduate to graduate school, and then nobody would hire me because I couldn't do the barrel work. I found another way in, which was through the laboratory. When I started in the late 70s, I believe there was only one woman winemaker at that time. It was Marianne Graff, and I believe she was the first and only woman winemaker post-Prohibition at the time that I met her. But an interesting thing about women's history in the wine business is that in 1890, 10% of the winemakers in California were women. Over 400 women owned vineyards in 1890, and the women winemakers won international competitions. In 1990, again, 10% of the winemakers in California were women. Today, I believe it's probably between 15 and 20%, and there are now women running wineries, such as myself. Michaela Rodino at St. Super, by the way, we're both from New Jersey. But the industry for women has really opened up. And sometimes women have found creative ways. A number of women are consultants so that it can work into family life or flexibility or whatever their lifestyles or life projections may be. I think men sometimes are a little less comfortable with going an alternative route. I have found winemaking to be a very, very rewarding career. Every so often someone says to me, what are you going to do next? When are you going to retire? What are you going to do when you retire? And I can't imagine coming to August and not bringing in a harvest. The smell of the grapes coming in, the smell of the new wine fermenting is to me the most fabulous and fulfilling thing in the world. I just absolutely love it.
Eileen, thank you so much for talking to us. It's been a real pleasure, and you've given us some fascinating information. So guys and gals, both of you can be winemakers if you'd like. It's just as simple as Eileen explained it.
And we'll take a break.
Hi, friends. I'm Phil Marcus, the host of Real Estate 101, heard every Saturday here on The Edge, AM 1550. If you've been thinking about selling your house or buying a house, I'd like to speak with you. Choosing the right agent is one of the first and most important steps in the process of buying or selling real estate. It's critical that you choose an agent who has the knowledge and experience to not only find that perfect new home for you, but to also be able to guide you step by step through the often complicated real estate process. If you don't already have a realtor, may I offer my services? I've been a real estate agent in Pittsburgh for almost 30 years. I'm a life member of the Realtors Association, and I'm proud to say that I've earned both the GRI and the coveted CRS professional designations. Won't you call me at RE/MAX Heritage? The phone number is 412-241-4200, extension 154, or my email address is phil@philmarcus.com. That's 412-241-4200, extension 154, or phil@philmarcus.com. Let's talk.
Furnace working okay? How's your heating bills? You know, no kidding, an old or inefficient furnace can really add to the cost of keeping your home warm.
If you want to keep costs down, get your furnace looked at, and I recommend Bolster to Heart Heating and Air Conditioning for that. The technicians at Bolster to Heart have been performing routine maintenance and installing high-efficiency heating and air conditioning systems in Pittsburgh since 1977. They're EPA-certified professionals who are continually factory-trained in all the latest installation and service techniques. They offer free estimates and don't even charge extra for Saturday service. They're a quality dealer you can trust. Stay warm this winter at the lowest possible cost. Call Bolster to Heart Heating and Air Conditioning at 412-367-3900. Maintenance or installation, Bolster to Heart Heating and Air Conditioning, 412-367-3900.
It all happened so fast. It was loud and scary, and I was trapped.
Katie is a kindergarten teacher in Pennsylvania. She was a passenger in a car struck head-on by a reckless driver.
That's when I met my guardian angel. His name is Sean, and he's a paramedic. Sean was there for me when I needed him. He knew just what to do, and he knew the right things to say.
Choose a career in emergency medical services. Call toll-free 877-PA-MEDIC. That's 877-PA-MEDIC.
Pennsylvania needs more guardian angels. I had mine, and he made all the difference.
We're back for our final segment. Again, as a reminder, if you just tuned into the program, Peter, co-host Peter, is flying solo today because Ann can't be with us. I think we're doing okay. The last segment, I hope you all enjoy, because Elaine Crane is just an absolutely fascinating person. We could have talked to her much longer than we did. And Domain Canaris is a spot that, first of all, you can't miss it on the horizon. You can't. And you definitely should go there. It's just a wonderful experience. If you're into sparkling wine and Pinot Noir, or just into generally having a good time, as you could probably hear in the background, there were lots of people doing exactly that. Now, Healdsburg, California, not too far away, is a place that we have been before. We've taken you there before to other establishments and talked about what a wonderful city it is. I guess it's a town probably rather than a city. If you go to Healdsburg, there's a wonderful restaurant there called Cyrus that you must go to. If you're interested in very fine dining in Northern California, then you should go to Healdsburg just to go to Cyrus, because it's that good a restaurant. And we were there and we caught up with the chef, and of course he talked to us about his restaurant.
On the menu is Back in Wine Country. We're currently in Healdsburg and California, of course, and we're making our first stop, which is the it's Shots of Stardom, almost in a wink of an eye, Cyrus. And we're talking to the chef co-owner, Douglas Keene. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for coming to visit us.
Tell us, just you're not a California guy. You are a Detroit-born person. Tell us just a quick path how you got here.
Sure. I was born in Dearborn, Michigan, and I went to school in upstate New York at Cornell University. And then from there, I moved down to Manhattan to cook for a number of years. And after my stint in Manhattan, I moved out west to California. Went to San Francisco to work with Tracy Desjardins, and then up to Wine Country, where Nick and I opened up Market, and then 2 years ago, Cyrus.
Now, this restaurant is in every magazine. You've already been nominated for a Beard Award. Tell us a little bit about it. How big is it? What's characteristic about it?
You know, Nick and I, really what we wanted to create was a world-class restaurant, and it happened to be in Sonoma County. We weren't looking to do a Sonoma-only restaurant. We just wanted a world-class restaurant that would compete on par with restaurants that you hear all the time. So it was a creation of 30 years of Nick's experience and 15 to 20 years of my experience cooking in kitchens. So it's really from the moment you start, from when you walk in to you finish, that you know that you're in a world-class experience and all your needs are taken care of. And that's really what we wanted to create.
Let's talk about food, your style of cooking. You say it's based on classic French techniques, but has a lot of Asian influence.
Yeah, I coined the phrase contemporary luxury simply because I had to. People ask you all the time, what style is your food? And it wasn't just French, it wasn't Asian. And California to me means something completely different. It's this simple, simplistic, only one thing on the plate type of thing. To me, it's contemporary luxury means it's contemporary, it's right now, it's what I've studied for the last 10, 20 years, what inspires me. Luxury means there's all the keynotes of luxury. We start with a caviar cart. We have three different foie gras. We have truffles on the menu.
Now, I've read about this caviar cart. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I'd love to. I was in Paris at the Ritz Hotel having dinner by myself, and up rolls this champagne cart. And I said, wow, what an incredible way to start a meal. I would love to do that for my restaurant. So Nick and I got together. We talked about the experience, and I think it was one of us came up with the idea, well, why don't we double it up with caviar? And so we can have this great experience. And so we have everything from American paddlefish to crude by the glass if you want. So you can spend a little bit or you can spend a lot. We weigh it against a gold coin, a real gold bullion coin. And it's just, it's over the top, but it's also accessible because it's not exclusive. And that's what we wanted.
You mean it's not exclusive in what way? Because it's not cheap.
Cheap? No, it's not cheap. But you're coming to Cyrus, you're going to spend some money. You're already in for it a little bit. But it's you can also buy a half ounce of paddlefish caviar for, I believe, I think it's $25 to split for two, and a half glass of champagne, a local sparkling, maybe, for $10 a glass. So you can, you know, you can get away with the caviar cart $25 if you want. And that, I mean, that was important to us. We didn't want this just to be people who were extremely wealthy could afford. We wanted this to be, if you were saving up for an anniversary, and this was your big splurge, that you could still have the caviar cart like everyone else did. And it was very important to us. It still is.
You like to do, you're such a pro, I must say. You just move with the flow here. I said you probably love doing the tasting menu most of all, and you said no, you actually like doing all of it.
Yeah, it was, one of our concepts was also that this experience needed to be about the guest. So you can't come into this restaurant, you don't want to come into this restaurant, and we don't want to tell you exactly what to do. We want this experience to be about what you wanted as a guest. So we designed the menu where if you felt like you're having fish three times tonight, you could do that at no extra charge. You want desserts? Great, you do it. You want to do fish entree, meat appetizer, you can do whatever you want. We'll give you guidelines, but there's a ton of flexibility into it. I love the chef's menu. It's a signature. We work on it daily. It's a source of pride and joy. We get to do super cool things with it. But I'm also very proud of the regular menu. I mean, there's items on there that sometimes move on to the tasting menu.
Well, I'm looking at all these, and I can't tell if you'd want, if you have more fun with fish, vegetables, or meat. I mean, it's all over the board.
I would say fish is my favorite. I love to cook fish. We get some beautiful stuff in from all over the country and from Japan. Fish gets me up more than anything else.
Doug, let's move on to your actual dishes. You're in love with some of them, but you like cooking all of them. But tell us about the ones you're really in love with.
Well, you know, the ones I'm in love with, I think, kind of comes and goes. There's a few on the menu that will always stay just because of the popularity of them. The Thai lobster, for one, under the fish and shellfish category. I think it's, number one, it's lobster, so people are drawn to it. Two, it's with avocados, which most people love. So we just did a really intense marinade with some Thai herbs, some fish sauce, some shallots, and a little bit of garlic, and it just all kind of comes together for a beautiful starter. It's a great way to start. And then the risotto as well is a kind of a signature that hasn't come off the menu, and I'd be okay to take it off, but I'd get an earful from some of the guests. So I just do a little differently with a red wine, with a pretty intense meat stock to cook it. And then instead of Parmesan in the actual dish, we actually do a broth out of Parmesan. So that the cheese doesn't actually break while it cooks. So it's got this really beautiful purple kind of color, and then this great orange broth on it. It's just kind of seductive to eat it. So those, I don't know if they're my favorite, but they're kind of two of the most popular, and I'm happy to keep cooking them as long as people want to order them.
And how many people do you get coming in here that regularly, or is it special? Is it a special destination restaurant?
You know, there's some locals, I should say, that will make this their restaurant. They also hang out in the bar quite a bit and do, because we offer the menu a la carte in the bar, so you could have one or two dishes instead of the prefix. But it's become kind of a destination restaurant. There's a lot of anniversaries, a lot of birthdays, a lot of graduations and celebrations of some sort, which is fun. It's fun to cook for that because people come in for the experience, and they come in, we're in your hands, we want to do this experience, and we're open to it. We're not going to the theater, we're not going to a show, we're not going to a party, we're here for dinner, which is so much fun. It's a treat. Even in the city, I wasn't able to do that as much as I am up here. It's more people come for the dinners, the experience, and it's been a lot of fun to cook for that.
Now, I'm just going to ask you something so specific. The kind of people that come to this area, do they do a tour like of the French Laundry, and do they do that?
Yeah, we get a lot of people that are doing that. They'll eat at Michael Mina Aqua in San Francisco. They'll go down to Los Gatos, eat at Manresa. They'll come up to eat at us, and then they'll go to French Laundry, or in some sort of order of that. It's, you know, it's fun. They come in the kitchen, and they always tell you you're the best, which is kind of fun. And I say, well, don't go anywhere else. Wait right now.
And tell our listeners just exactly where you are.
We are located on 29 North Street in Healdsburg, California, which is about an hour and 20 minutes north of the Golden Gate Bridge. And we're on just one block off this the town square of Healdsburg.
I might correct you about this 1 hour and something. If you're doing it on a Friday afternoon, it can take three, which is exactly what happened to us. Website.
www.cyrusrestaurant.com.
Thanks, Chef. Love talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
And this was indeed a great spot. He mentioned, incidentally, restaurant Michael Mina in San Francisco, and you'll recall that we had Chef Chris Omidu on the other day. And I have to leave now, but next time we're going to play the interviews with the bartender at Cyrus, who's a fabulous guy. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next week, same time, same place.
To match your pretty eyes.
Nope. See, all colors have wavelengths that are diffused by oxygen and nitrogen. Since blue has the shortest wavelength, it's diffused up to 10 times more.
Who taught you that?
Mommy.
By 6th grade, too many girls lose interest in math and science, which they'll need for most future jobs. Keep her interest alive. For ideas, go to girlsgotech.org. It's her future. Do the math. A public service message brought to you by Girl Scouts of the USA and the Ad Council.
Do that.
Mommy.
By 6th
Jazzin' Around with David J. is next on The Edge, AM 1550.